Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 15th. This is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And also with us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Hi, Gwen.
Hi, Steve.
And later in the program, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We'll also check in with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from WCAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean talking State House news. And we'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. The 2020 census could have big implications for the Cape region. That was one of the messages delivered by Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who was at Barnstable Town Hall on Wednesday. Sarah, give us a quick primer on the census. It's a population count. Why is it so important?
Sure. So the census essentially, that count will determine what types of federal funding the Cape and Islands receive. And so those can be anything from, people have mentioned, the bridges. Those are managed by a federal agency. The National Seashore, also managed by a federal agency. And of course, schools, roads, all of that good stuff. The Cape gets a significant chunk of federal funding for all of that, about $2,400 per person is the average.
Gwen, Secretary of State Galvin and others at the Wednesday meeting were pointing to hard-to-count populations as being particularly important. Who are some of these populations, and why are they hard to count?
Some of this is specific to the Cape. For example, the snowbird population, which goes away. He mentioned immigrants and homeless folks, and as people that might not be as easy to reach. So,
Sarah, I know you've done some early reporting on the census across the region. Talk to us a little bit about the challenges of reaching some of these hard to count populations and how they even differ from one end of our region to the other.
Sure. So right now, things are still in the very early stages of planning. The official census is not going to be taken until April of 2020. So we're still quite a few months out. But right now, they're getting groups together to address those specific hard to count populations. It looks as if there are going to be some anchor organizations like churches or nonprofits who interface pretty often with these hard to count groups. A lot of them will be setting up centers to help people fill out the census, whether it's computer centers or translation centers, and they'll also be handling those ground roots outreach efforts to kind of tell people what's coming and what you should do if someone comes to knock on your door.
When we talk about the challenges of counting some of these populations, we think about, immigrant populations or foreign-born populations who aren't. Right now there's maybe a level of distrust with revealing yourself to the government. How are the census counters sort of approaching that? What's their expectation there?
Yeah, so as our listeners may know, there was definitely a lot of fear that there was going to be a citizenship question on the census, which made a lot of immigrants who may have undetermined status very, very worried. That is no longer on the census. It is not being included this year. But of course, there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think, especially if you're a population that may not speak English very well, you may not be aware that that is not actually a question. And so I think these groups are nonprofits and translation services are really going to be trying to get the word out about what is true about the census, why you shouldn't be afraid of this, and that this information is not going to be released to organizations like ICE or anything like that.
The census happens every 10 years. And so you, at one point, I remember as you were doing your early reporting on this, were talking about how Barnstable County was near to a threshold that in the last census, that if we fall below, there's a significant drop in federal funding that comes to us.
Yeah, the Cape currently has 215,000 people, according to its 2010 census. And, the Cape will drop another level. I'm sorry, I can't remember what the name is. But if we drop below 200,000 people, we are going to have a change. There could be a change in our federal funding. We become another tier.
It's a big step down, a big tier down.
Yeah.
So that's just 15,000 people. You can understand why people who are putting together the Cape want to make sure that everybody is counted here. Bill Galvin says he's going to be holding other meetings like this around the state, but he wanted to start here on the Cape. Gwen, this is the first of these meetings with local officials around the state. Why start here?
Well, partly because of that challenge, but also there was a couple of things that he said that were particularly interesting. One was he talked about this being a bipartisan effort, and also about a grant that would help to draw in partners that aren't normally associated with the census, churches, shelters, that kind of thing. So that would bring a new way of getting the message out and address some of the issues that that Sarah has talked about in terms of reassuring people that this is a numbers game. It's not to be something that is making people reveal themselves, just being counted in the number of people who are here.
Now, one of the other things Bill Galvin mentioned when he was here, again, the Massachusetts Secretary of State, was that he wanted to start here because he felt like the trying to get the numbers of people who leave for the winter,
right,
the Cape.
The snowbirds,
he wanted
yes.
to start here as soon as possible. And I was thinking, well, we're already into November. He sort of missed a big window perhaps there. But the census takes place. Tell us when it starts so that folks have an idea of when this all gets going.
Yeah. So it's officially taken in April of 2020. I think a lot of these efforts, like these call centers, these census centers are going to be starting probably around like February or March. And they're going to start organizing in kind probably starting January. So we've got a little bit to go. I've been to a couple of these meetings where they do talk about how they can do outreach to particular groups. And right now it kind of seems like it's in the planning stages, trying to figure out what is the best way to reach these groups. So nothing real. I think we're really going to start to see things ramp up in January.
WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times is going to stick around with us here. Gwen, let's talk about another story this week. The Coast Guardsman found guilty in a 2015 shooting rampage in Bourne is seeking to have his conviction overturned. This is Adrian Loya, and his attorney went before the state's highest court to make the appeal.
They did. It's interesting that, let me back up a little bit. I think a lot of people know about this story because it was certainly rampage is not the wrong word. It was there was a lot happening. And this Mr. Loya was found guilty in a 2015 shooting, and he had shot to death Anna Trubnikova. Sorry,
Trubnikova. Yes.
Thank you, Trubnikova, and wounded her wife. They were fellow Coast Guardsmen that he had known in Alaska.
I just want to make sure we're correct here. Lisa Trubnikova
killed, his
and,
wife,
and her yeah. wife was Anna Trubnikova, who was injured in that shooting.
Yes, and she was injured, as was Bourne police officer. In addition to the shootings, Mr. Loya had placed incendiary devices to slow down responders when they came. This all happened in a condo in Bourne. So he was convicted of first degree murder. And, prosecutors said that he had spent more than a year planning this. He was convicted of first degree murder and 20 other charges in connection with that early morning rampage. And his conviction came in 2017. And now he is at the Supreme Judicial Court to appeal. You may know that first-degree murder in this state comes with an automatic appeal. So he's making the point that he has, through his lawyers, made before, that the jury in the first case was improperly charged, that they weren't given the option of finding him. They were only given two options, and he was looking for the third one, which was to be found not guilty by reason of insanity. That's what he's arguing for. It's interesting. I'm going to stop talking and let you
No, that's okay. There's actually this sort of subtle nuance here in what they're arguing, because they're not contesting, obviously. They're not contesting that Adrian Loya did
right.
any of these things. But the jurors were asked to find him either guilty, not guilty, or not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility, meaning that his sanity, he couldn't tell what
right.
what he was doing was wrong, essentially. But what the lawyer for Adrian Loya is arguing here is that the jurors should have been able to find him guilty but not criminally responsible. And the jurors being charged to say not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility wouldn't feel that they could do that because they weren't contesting that he'd done it. So it's hard for them to say the words not guilty. He wanted the jury to be offered was guilty but not criminally responsible.
Because it was more emotionally palatable to the jury.
That's right.
However, in this most recent appearance, the Justice Barbara Lenk said that wasn't really an option. It would require a legislative act to put that language in exactly. So the high court took this under advisement, but she did point out that it might not be within the purview of the court to do that.
That description, guilty but not criminally responsible, isn't even in the state law as an option. Let's talk about State Attorney General Mara Healey. She came to Hyannis on Friday. She was here to address a statewide conference of school administrators. She touched on a number of topics, and one of the big ones being the opioid crisis.
This is a battle that's being fought everywhere, as you know, Steve, but especially in the schools, because not only through drug use, but through the effects of it, having parents who are involved, you know, teachers are facing a much bigger challenge in helping children to arrive ready to learn. And State Attorney General Maura Healey was actually speaking to the Massachusetts Association of School Committees and also the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents and down at the Resort and Conference Center in Hyannis. They talked a bit about options as I said, they talked a bit about the fact that these leave some of the kids in the custody of state welfare advocates and, as well as, traumatized from being in an environment where opioids are being used.
It means that so much of the a bigger portion of the burden of helping kids to cope with these impacts is being passed along to schools and to educators.
That's true. There are some tools that are set up to help educators. And 2.5 years ago, Healy and the GE Foundation announced $2 million in funds for Project HERE. And that provides substance prevention education for free to every public middle school in Massachusetts. It's implemented by the Health Resources in Action Project HERE. It's an online toolkit for educators. It has resources and even games, to sort of get kids involved in role-playing and in talking about the problems that they may be facing. And of interest, I think, was the fact that Healy reiterated that she's opposed to arming teachers and says that she wants to arm them with information such as that what's available in Project HERE. And also in the Sandy Hook promise, there was some money put into that recently. And I think it's $1 million there, to also support this effort to help teachers be prepared for kids who aren't ready to learn because they may not have had breakfast, they may not have had any parental involvement. This is something that she, part of her message.
This is another of Cape Cod's seasonal markers here. The first cold-stunned sea turtles have begun washing ashore. This happens each year.
It does, and the stream of them has been pretty steady, so I'm not going to try and break down how many each day. We're hearing 27 turtles in total, and four of those have died, or were dead on the beach. This involves scores of volunteers, and if you saw the photos from this week, you can tell how dedicated they are because they're wearing parkas and hoods and walking in the water. So these little turtles, particularly the Ridley Kemp variety, are highly endangered, and the goal is to get them up out of the water line and you know, sort of put some seaweed on them to keep them warm until they can be transported for care to the facility in Quincy. And they are, you know, regularly shipped up there, but it's almost a commuter route, it seems, after after all these years.
And these are turtles that particularly are getting caught within sort of the hook, the upturned arm of Cape Cod Bay, and they're trying to go south, but of course there's a big land mass in
the way. Exactly.
And so finding them and getting them getting them as soon as possible and being able to rehabilitate them is so important. And one thing they did suggest is what to do if you find one, and that is that you want to mark where you found a turtle and call the sanctuary. You can call them
at 508-349-2615.
Whatever you do, don't try to put it back in the water.
Right, exactly. Yes, that would be unkind, unfair, and counterproductive.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
And George, a Tisbury selectman wants to end the practice of people having to order food if they get an alcoholic beverage. Not everyone is welcoming of this idea. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it was an emotional meeting for the Tisbury Board of Selectmen. Steve, have you ever heard of this type of practice anywhere else where you go into a restaurant?
This is very particular, right?
It is. It's particular to Tisbury. It was done through home rule petition. And when you go into a restaurant, you have to order some food before you can be served an alcoholic beverage. And this was very important to people at the time. Started when the town went from dry to beer and wine, and then about 18 months ago, the town went all alcohol, meaning you could get a martini or some other mixed drink with a meal as well. But again, kept that designation where you had to have a meal. Now a selectman, Jeff Crystal, says it's time to change that. That still the town is having difficulty competing with Oak Bluffs and Edgartown, where you know you can go in and have a beer and you know, that's it, and be on your way. You can't do that in Tisbury. He's saying that the town is losing some business as a result of that, particularly people, you know, who might, you know, jump into a restaurant while they're waiting for a ferry in Vineyard Haven. But at least one selectman is already saying that no promises were made, and she's not going to budge on this. But she did agree to hold a public hearing about it in January. But the real excitement started when one of a local business owner, who's also opposed to this, you know, made an impassioned plea, and he ended up actually walking out of the meeting and slamming the door. He was so upset that in his mind, the town would be going back on its promise of not moving forward with something that he says would constitute having bars in the town.
So his fear is that this whole process has been kind of a slippery slope, that they've started, opened the door to this, and now they keep sort of lowering the bar of what people need in order to get a drink.
That's right. You know, you hit the nail on the head right there.
So there's going to be a public meeting now about this where they can the town can address it?
Yeah, so in January they're going to hold a public hearing, and that will sort of determine whether to go forward before voters in the spring at town meeting to put this before them, because this would have to go before town meeting. Any change in this home rule petition has to go before the all the voters in town at a town meeting.
And real quick, I want to ask you about another story in the paper, which is a real estate story. A much-watched piece of property is now under contract, but still no word if the buyer is who everyone thinks it might be.
Right. So this property is in Edgartown. It was on the market for $14.8 million. It is no longer on the market. Someone has it under agreement. The realtor wouldn't tell us who it is, but the Obamas have been looking at it. There's a couple of clues here. Michelle Obama, of course, made that surprise visit to the library in Edgartown in the middle of October. The Obamas are never on the island in the fall. It's always an August vacation for them. So that was a big clue. This is the house that they stayed in this particular August, and they really liked it. So, and you know, there have been all kinds of stories out there saying that they're the potential buyers of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is an interesting little piece of the story that TMZ checks in, and TMZ, as people know, is sort of the gossipy news outlet. They check in every day with the Register of Deeds to see, has it happened yet?
Well, one of these mornings we're going to find out yay or nay. So we'll
absolutely.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
And now we're going to jump over to Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Good. Tim, the Chatham community of Little Beach is facing a dilemma with erosion and sea level rise. You've got a great two-part story that takes a close look at what's really become a representative. It starts really with a little bit of history, how this was not always considered prime real estate.
Sure. This first part of the story this week takes a deep dive into the history of Little Beach, which for those who may not know the geography, it's the area just south of Chatham Light, sort of on the way to Morris Island. Now, for many years of the town's history, it was pretty much considered worthless marsh area, so much so that the area immediately south of the lighthouse was the town dump at one point. But eventually that became the home to more than, right now there's more than 80 properties down there, and they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars. During the early 20th century, there had been just a few houses there, but eventually between the 1920s and 50s, the Horn family developed a number of summer cottages. And in 1957, there was an inlet between Stage Harbor and Chatham Harbor that sort of cut through between Morris Island and Little Beach. That was closed up with a dredging project by the Army Corps of Engineers that created a causeway that is now Morris Island Road, which is the direct link to Morris Island that led to the development not only of Morris Island, but that dredging material filled in a lot of the marsh in Little Beach, and that was eventually developed into multi-million-dollar properties.
And now it's been facing an increasing threat from storms and erosion, and there's obviously, with multi-million-dollar properties there instead of summer cottages, there's a lot at stake here for homeowners.
Indeed. The area is extremely low. It's only a few feet above sea level. Back after the 1987 break in North Beach, across from Chatham Light, there was a lot of erosion in that area. It sort of died down a bit for a while, but a few years ago, that started up again as the barrier beach is breaking apart, allowing more ocean waves and higher water levels into the Little Beach area. If you remember, in 2018, there were a series of winter storms, really inundated the area. There was a photo, a very sort of almost iconic now photo of a rescue boat taking people out of that area. So you've got what is essentially, multi-million-dollar houses really exposed to the ocean with not much protection at all. And scientists say that's just going to be more vulnerable because of sea level rise and climate change. And property owners are working to develop a shoreline protection plan to try to stem that erosion. But there are impediments to it. The dunes are low-lying areas. You can't have revetments in an area like that because it's coastal dune. State law prohibits that. There's a marina in the middle of the neighborhood, and during those 2018 storms, the floodwater came right up the boat ramp, basically, and helped sort of flood that area. And also, the entire area is in private hands, so the town's interest is limited. But the town right now is working with those neighbors to sponsor a FEMA grant to help fund some shoreline protection there. And we actually expect to learn any day now of the fate of that grant. And that, as well as other plans for that area, will be the subject of the second part of our story in next week's paper.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm going to speak right now with Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, Steve.
Jeanette, the cleanup of New Bedford Harbor has been going along with money from a big settlement with one of the polluting companies. That money is going to run out next year, but the cleanup won't be done yet.
Right. So in 2012, there was a settlement from AVX Corporation, which is the successor to Aerovox, the largest of the known polluters of New Bedford Harbor, which is contaminated with PCBs and heavy metals. That was $366 million, and it really accelerated the work over the last 6 or 7 years, changed the timeline, the entire timeline of the cleanup in the harbor from what was expected to take like 40 years to a much shorter timeline. Now that money is running out probably around the end of 2020, and the EPA knew this was coming, but it does leave some parts undone, and they are primarily the intertidal areas along the shorelines, not every intertidal area, but many of them.
Explain for us, give us a little sense of where those, what has to be done still and where the, what they're looking at trying to get done.
Right. So there's this inlet on the east side of the Acushnet River, which is, of course, is the northernmost part of New Bedford Harbor. There's an inlet over there that's across from where Aerovox was that is highly contaminated, and that will be covered by the settlement. But south of there, all along the Fairhaven shoreline, there are multiple what they call zones of the cleanup areas, all in all the little inlets and shoreline right there in Fairhaven, south of where Aerovox was. And then on the New Bedford side, there's some other sections, again, south of Aerovox that won't be covered by the original settlement.
So I guess the question is, what happens when the money runs out and the job still isn't finished?
Right. I should mention, too, that I do have a map. That's a little bit difficult to explain all those locations.
Yeah.
But I have a map on my story at southcoasttoday.com. There's a map of those areas. So before the settlement, they were getting $15 million a year toward the cleanup from the EPA Superfund. And so what they anticipate is that that will happen again. Of course, things have changed at the EPA since 2012, right, because with the presidential administration, things are not the same. So they don't really know what's going to happen. But the spokeswoman for the Boston area EPA did say, you know, they feel confident or optimistic, at least, that considering how close to completion this project is, that they will get funding. And if they did get that $15 million a year, you would be potentially looking at about 4.5 years to fund the rest of the budget they're anticipating. So it's possible that, you know, things could go along in a fairly routine fashion going forward if they get that funding.
That's Jeanette Barnes from the New Bedford Standard Times. Jeanette, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
We're going to speak now with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Marianne, finding a parking spot in Provincetown can be a challenge, particularly in the summer. Now, a big change is being proposed for how residents use the town's most central parking lot.
It is true about parking. I think that's the most common question people ask me when they're coming to Provincetown is, where am I going to park?
Even when I came to see you about a month ago, you had very specific suggestions for where I should try to find a parking spot. Yes.
Well, I think the town is trying to basically squeeze more money out of this municipal parking lot. That's what it's called, and it's known as the MPL. It's right at the entrance of the pier, and you can park there either by paying, you know, a daily rate or if you have a parking sticker. And so the idea is that, and what it appears to be is that the town earns more money if they fill up the parking lot with everybody who's just paying a daily rate. So they're basically trying to discourage people to park there who have stickers. And so they've changed the parking sticker rate for next year. It starts May 1st. So that it's almost like you have to pay $95 more to include the MPL if you have a sticker.
So if you had a sticker before,
penalty.
Right, before all of this, if you had a sticker, you could just park at this municipal parking lot without any additional charge. They're suggesting now you need this big $95 additional charge to use the lot. Is that right?
That's right. Just like as a resident, I used to pay $55, and I could pretty much park anywhere really during the summer or during the parking season. But now, if I want to be able to park at the MPL, I would need kind of an additional $95, kind of an additional payment on with my sticker. So
tell us a little bit. Not surprisingly, there are people with a little pushback on this. Explain what some of the thinking is in the conversation here.
Well, apart from the fact that it's expensive, if you're a resident. One thing is, like, the town board members, so these are like town committee members, right now, like, let's say they're a resident, they would pay $55 if they were just kind of a regular person in town, but to compensate them for their committee work, that sticker is really is reduced to $5. So the whole thing about, and they like to park at the MPL because it's very close to town hall. But now they're going to have to pay that additional premium price as well. So committee members, they used to pay just $5 for their sticker. I mean, they can still park other places in the summer, but if they wanted to park at the MPL, which is near town hall, they'd have to also pay that
$95.
Does that make any sense?
It's yes, a lot of it's numbers, complicated.
But you can... like, it's irritating. There, that's it.
Hey, listen, live here. Let me ask you another story that is somewhat related in that it's about, I don't know how related here. There's a suggestion to change a street name in Provincetown, and it sounds like it would honor a late resident while also eliminating some confusion, but not everybody is on board with this here.
Right. This one of the two main roads in Provincetown that go east to west or west to east is Bradford Street. And so at some point in the past, that road was extended west. So that extension is right now it's called Bradford Street Extension, which apparently causes a lot of confusion with deliveries. So in the past 2 years, residents on that road have tried to get the name of that changed. So last year they tried to change it to Dorothy Bradford Street, which she's a woman who was married to William Bradford way back in 1620 when they the pilgrims came. But so that didn't go anywhere. The selectmen didn't go for that at the traffic hearing last year. But now this year, another resident is trying to do Mary Oliver Street, which is the late poet who, you know, lived for many decades here in Provincetown. So they've agreed to move forward with that, with the Mary Oliver Street. But the business people who live on that road are kind of concerned that suddenly, all of a sudden, their address is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we got a letter to the editor that said that Mary Oliver was really a lover of nature, and that if anything should be named in her honor, it should be like a nature trail rather than a
Not
street.
Not a street, yes. It's Mary Ann Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. Mary Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With us now is Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, the island's Wampanoag tribe, the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah, is holding an election this Sunday. This seems like it would be kind of a big event, but it's come up rather quietly.
Yes. So incumbent chairman of the tribe, Cheryl Andrews Maltese, is facing a challenge from a political newcomer. His name's Kevin Devine. We didn't know about the election until recently, which is sometimes how these things go. They are closed elections. They happen during a general tribal membership meeting, so they're not open to the public. Tribal members have to vote in person at tribal headquarters off Blackbrook Road in Aquinnah. So often we don't find out about the elections until, you know, up until the weekend beforehand. It's coming at a pivotal moment for the tribe. As many people know, in 2018, the Supreme Court declined to hear arguments in a case that the town brought that challenged the tribe's gaming rights. So they were cleared to build this Class 2 bingo hall. And then 1 year later, they broke ground, and there was public reaction. There was legal threats. Eventually, they went back to court, but now it seems like construction has been halted. And, you know, there's a little bit of a lull in the casino end, but, yeah, this is you know, interesting. And we're going to, and I think kind of the divisions about the casino project are characterizing, it seems, this election.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because Cheryl Andrews Maltese, the tribal chair, is a supporter of the casino and has really been pushing to move that forward. Her
yeah.
challenger here in this election is not.
No, Cheryl has, their chairwoman, well, Andrews Maltese, she's pretty much been the leader of the tribe's pursuit of the gaming facility. In her view, it's a form of economic development. It's an expression of tribal sovereignty. You know, it's a way for tribal members to express their rights. And Mr. Devine feels differently. I talked to him this week, and he said that he has cited sort of safety concerns about alcohol. He thinks that basically many of the people who are on the island, many of the tribal members, don't want there to be a casino. The tribe, just a little bit of background on its demographics, has about 1,300 members, and only about 300 of them live on island, and 98 live on tribal lands in Aquinnah. So the tribe has a large off-island population, and I think the casino has been a dividing force between both the on-island and off-island members. So, yeah, there is this sort of disagreement among tribal members about what direction to take with regard to the casino.
It would be interesting to be following the story as we find out what happens this Sunday and how the tribe lines up here. That's Noah Asmo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
State House lawmakers have less than 2 weeks left in their formal legislative calendar for 2019 and have a lot to get done before the deadline. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean, who's counting down the days before lawmakers recess for the rest of the year. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you.
So it's crunch time on Beacon Hill, huh?
It really is. There's only a couple days. It's next Wednesday is when they all turn into to pumpkin pie here on Beacon Hill, so to speak. So, yeah, we are counting down. They have a number of kind of big ticket items to get through before they break, and they won't be back until January.
They have a lot of big bills on their plate. What realistically might they get to?
Right. Well, this is the end of the first year of the 2 year legislative session. So, but usually this is the halftime period, so to speak. And they want to get some wins on the scoreboard to belabor that metaphor even further. And the biggest thing that they're looking at is education funding. This is something that the House and Senate hatched a plan. They kind of pre-agreed to it before the chambers passed their versions of the bills with the hope that they wouldn't be that different when it came down to putting a bill onto Governor Baker's desk. But of course, Democrats kind of went in different directions over oversight of that. So we'll see how empowered the state is to control this new money that is going to end up going to school districts going forward. And that's something, you know, that has to do with the funding formula and how much districts are going to get. It's going to be $1.5 billion over 7 years. And so that's something that they really need to make a deal on that before Wednesday.
That'll be interesting to see if that happens. Speaking of pumping new money into the system, the House plans to take up a tax bill that will help with transportation spending. Do you think that will happen before the holiday, before Wednesday?
That will happen in the House for sure. That's something that, well, maybe not for sure, but it's something that House leaders, Speaker Robert DeLeo, has said he definitely wants to get done through that chamber. That's really a part of a much bigger debate over taxation. The Senate has not weighed in. They do not have an equivalent bill in the queue before the holiday break on taxes. Senate President Karen Spilk has been looking at tax reform as well as kind of revenue ideas. The House plan that they're going to take up next week is most likely much more targeted to transportation itself, meaning it could be something like an increase to the gas tax to pay for roads, bridges, maybe the MBTA, things like that. When they come back next year in the 2020 session, we'll see a much more robust, bigger idea kind of thing between the House and Senate that will then move forward towards the governor.
Okay, so there'll be some closed door discussions about this. The House is kind of just teeing this up to set the agenda after they come back in the new year. Is that what you're saying here?
Yeah. If you're looking for open doors, the State House is not the place to you'll find it. You know, the decisions are made with the, you know, the leadership, the House Speaker, the Senate President, and their kind of close circle. Very little is done by the rank and file around here. So the fact that most lawmakers are on recess doesn't really matter all that much. It means they can't have full formal sessions. But the people that make the decisions are, of course, still in charge and having those talks and making those decisions over the holiday break.
Another bill lawmakers have vowed to finish up this session is a bill on regulating vape products. And the House was actually set to vote on a bill to ban products with flavors, including menthol, this week. Did that happen?
Yeah, that happened on Wednesday. The House was in their full session, and they did pass that ban on menthol cigarettes and all flavored tobacco. It was it's a pretty big deal. They're calling it a first-in-the-nation kind of comprehensive bill. What it does is it adds new regulations to vape sales, like, you know, registering retailers of vape products, things like that. Adds an excise tax at the wholesale level onto vapes to make them equivalent to the taxes that are on cigarettes, so that when vapes come back for sale, vape products are going to have far fewer flavors. There won't be really any selection outside of different kinds of tobacco-flavored vape products. And the price is going to be much, much higher, again, equivalent to traditional tobacco because of that new excise tax. And for anyone who was smoking traditional menthol cigarettes, those are going to be off the shelves as well come June.
There's been a lot of pushback on the idea of banning menthol cigarettes from folks like small business owners. But then on the other side, there's been a lot of talk about how the ban might be a good thing because menthol is marketed heavily to communities of color.
Yes, we heard an awful lot from store owners who really do run small businesses in communities. Because these products are so prevalent in communities of color, they're really going to hurt the corner store that in some areas really is the only purveyor of fresh food, produce, things like that in a neighborhood. So it kind of came at it from the small business angle. Of course, Big Tobacco also has a lot of money to lose when you ban a very popular product like this. So their lobby were pretty active. But tobacco and the convenience stores were not successful. Only 5 Democrats voted against this bill. So it was a very clear majority in the House that went along with this. So we'll see what Governor Baker decides on it. But it looks like Democrats do have the votes to override any kind of gubernatorial veto.
And speaking of Governor Charlie Baker, he announced a new head of the state police department this week. There's been quite a bit of scandal that's rocked the state police over this last year. But now they have a new leader, and he's done a lot of work on the Cape and Islands.
Yeah, Christopher Mason is the new superintendent and colonel of the state police. He's a 26-year veteran of the state police. He's been a detective. He hails from the Cape. He's worked on Cape Cod and in Barnstable County for a lot of his career. Most recently, he had been the number 2 deputy to Carrie Gilpin, who is the retiring superintendent of the state police. And if you remember, she was brought in the wake of that massive overtime abuse scandal from last year. A number of troopers were falsifying timesheets and essentially stealing tax dollars from the Commonwealth. So now that there's a new boss in town, he said he's going to continue a number of the initiatives that Gilpin put in place to kind of reform the culture of the state police, and he wants to change things at the academy. He said he wants to do more mandatory ethics training, training on de-escalation techniques, and really to de-emphasize the paramilitary attitude that sometimes police take when it comes to the training at the academy, at least.
The RMV released a new ID this week that will allow a person to choose the letter X as a gender designation instead of M for male or F for female.
Yeah, this is a policy change that has come with new software upgrades at the RMV. It's not just driver's licenses. There's a lot of, you know, voter registration. It's a very complicated database of citizens in Massachusetts. So adding a third gender category, as this would, non-binary X instead of an M or an F, is a lot more complicated on a technical and bureaucratic level than you may think. The legislative side of this is that this was a bill, there was a bill in the legislature that Karen Spilka, the Senate president, had been pushing last year that gained no traction in the House. It kind of fell victim to some, politics. But the RMV never needed legislative legal authority to do it anyway. When this new software came on, apparently the Baker administration agrees with the policy. They added the option.
One last thing. We heard from a former governor this week, and that's Deval Patrick. He is running for president. Any predictions, Mike?
I have no idea. I tend to stay out of that kind of stuff.
Smart.
It looks like New Hampshire is a whole different kind of politics, exactly. But, you know, I covered Patrick for a long time here at the State House, so I know him and his background and his policies pretty well. So hopefully I can have a little bit of input on the coverage, at least how public radio stations like ours cover the Patrick campaign as it goes forward. I'm sure I can shed some light on a few things like that.
And that is State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us, as he does most weeks, from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks.
Thank you, Catherine. Great to be with you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. Major opposition is being seen on Nantucket to a paid parking plan. With us to talk about it now is Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, we've talked before about this plan to bring new paid parking to downtown, but it does seem now to have provoked some strong opposition. Tell us about this.
It has, and the debate over and the discussion about paid parking in downtown Nantucket has been going on for more than a decade. Nantucket has always had free parking downtown with a ticketing system for when you overpark your one-hour, two-hour, half-hour spots. But town officials in the last couple of years have really decided on an idea of paid parking in an attempt to ease some of the traffic congestion downtown and encourage more people perhaps to take alternative forms of transportation into the downtown area. And the system they're hoping to implement or had hoped to implement by this summer would work something like this. Motorists driving into town would find a place to park, log on to an app on their smartphone, plug in their location and their license plate number, and click on a button to pay for as much time as they wanted over a certain amount of allotted time that was a grace period. That would differ, according to town officials, in different parts of town. And for people who didn't have a smartphone, there's been discussion about putting up kiosks or computers in downtown buildings for people to pay. It didn't take long, however, after this was unveiled a week or two ago, to start generating really widespread opposition, like you said. There's a lot of concerns about from downtown business owners, residents, and town officials alike that range from complaints that the proposed plan favors wealthier visitors over islanders who can easily afford to pay for however as much time they want to park and not really worry about moving their car at all. They say that it might allow people to keep their cars downtown longer, never have to move their spots from even a two-hour spot, and is really inaccessible to people who don't own smartphones. And these concerns are even starting to get the attention of the Select Board Chair, Dawn Holgate, who at last Wednesday's meeting was starting to reconsider whether the system could be implemented by this spring, this summer, or maybe shouldn't even be implemented at all. There are several board members, however, who still see benefits to the idea. They say that having a system in place, once the kinks get worked out, would really incentivize people to consider carpooling, biking, or taking alternative forms of transportation into town, and would probably ease up some of the traffic congestion of people still circling for parking spaces over and over. The board hasn't made a firm decision yet about whether to abandon the program, but the plan still is, at this point, to try and get something implemented by the start of the summer season in next May or June.
Hey, I want to ask you briefly about another story you have. The town has added some new hires and is considering a whole bunch more, and this is kind of part of a larger effort. Tell us about
it. It is. It's part of a larger effort that really sort of got moving following the economic recession and global downturn back in 2008. The town did some restructuring and laid off some employees and consolidated some positions, and they recently added five new positions. They're considering 11 more. It's part of a larger staffing plan that came out of a $114,000 study by an off-island consulting group that recommended the hires, recommended a number of other things, including implementation of new software, some new policies across the board. But the big one really is the hires. Each full-time hire would cost the town in the neighborhood of about $100,000 a year when you factor in health insurance if the hire were to take a family health insurance plan. Town officials say they're being cautious, but the town can afford this. There is some money within the 2.5% Proposition 2.5% mm-hmm. that they're allowed to raise every year, and there's some mm-hmm. new revenue coming in from both the marijuana dispensary tax and the tax on mm-hmm. short-term vacation mm-hmm. rentals that they may be able to use. But they're going to phase these in, they say, make the final decision on those additional 11 over time, and discuss them before they start adding them to the payroll.
It's Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Hey, Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I want to thank all our contributors today. We heard from WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan, Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Jeanette Barnes at the New Bedford Standard Times, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and with our Statehouse reporter, Mike Dean. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.